WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
And welcome to WrestleSpective, the show that reviews old main events of pay-per-views. I am Jason Mann, and my guest today is Franny, the owner and operator of RotoReels.com. Welcome to the show.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
Sure, no problem. And we have a very special match to talk about today. Well, they're all special matches, but this one in particular is different because it is a not one of the major promotions that I usually talk about, at least not directly. It is AAA's When Worlds Collide pay-per-view from 1994, and particularly the main event of Conan versus Paraguayo.
Yeah, it was certainly a historic historic pay-per-view, and it was actually Mike Tenay's first United States announcing job, I think.
Yeah.
Or first overall.
Right, and he did a fantastic job. Obviously very knowledgeable about Lucha Libre and AAA in particular, and was really, I thought he did a wonderful job of explaining to someone who doesn't know about much about Lucha Libre some of the particulars, and I thought that he was really excellent. Chris Cruz, maybe not quite as good, although he had his good and bad moments throughout the show, which we can talk about. But basically, this was during the time in the early 90s when Mexican wrestling was really hot, when AAA broke away from CMLL and became kind of the second promotion there and was kind of the hipper, you know, hotter, had kind of more of the young talent and kind of had a different approach than the very traditional, you know, CMLL, if I'm not mistaken.
As far as I remember, yeah. I was reading an article a couple of weeks ago, actually, that was written by Mike Tenay. I should have found it to bring it up right now, but it was back from like 2001 or something. But he was actually saying that AAA around the article was about the history of Triple Mania, and Tenay was actually saying that AAA, you know, in the mid 90s. They reached a point where they were actually bigger than both WCW and WWF.
They really, you know, they made some inroads in the United States into Los Angeles and to, you know, some of the other cities, and they were doing very, very well. You know, it was really only probably for a couple of years, but they really were.
Yeah.
You know, there was kind of this time, and it's sort of showcasing the show where it was sort of like, okay, maybe Lucha is the future of wrestling in the United States.
And that's undoubtedly that's why we saw Eric Bischoff bring in Mike Tenay and bring in all the Lucha stars, and Bischoff was actually the person who pushed the idea of When Worlds Collide, if I recall correctly. I would imagine to capitalize on the success. I think it was Triple Mania 1 or 2. I think they drew, I want to say 40,000 or something. So
yeah,
it was really a big
right.
deal around that time.
Yeah, definitely. It was huge. There's no question. And Conan was a major star in Mexico. I mean, he was a major wrestling star. He was a soap opera star. I mean, he was really a big cultural figure in Mexico during that time.
Yeah.
So, looking at the whole card, there's a lot of guys who really, really became important to, you know, wrestling, not just, obviously not just in the United States, but certainly in the United States. I mean, if you're talking about Rey Mysterio Jr., who's, one of the biggest stars of the last 20 years, both in the United States and obviously in Mexico, Psicosis, who was a really big deal in the late 90s, early 2000s, Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero, obviously, incredibly big stars, Conan and, other guys who are well known, like Too Cold Scorpio. Tito Santana is on this show. Parca, just a lot of, El Hijo del Santo, who's obviously the son of El Santo, one of the, maybe the biggest wrestling star of all time, and certainly in Mexico, and, his son, who's a huge deal as well. So a lot of not only really important wrestlers, but also great wrestlers. I mean, up and down, this show is just really, really fantastic. I'd never seen the whole show. I'd seen bits and pieces of it over, the years, but this really is from top to bottom. Just every match delivers kind of on a different level, but they all deliver really well, I think.
Yeah, no two matches are alike. And I mean, even the opening match, the mini match, I've never been a fan, never really given that style, much attention. But I mean, that match was fast, high flying, and really impressive, even that. And the whole card is phenomenal.
Yeah, it really is. And even the two six-man matches are different with, the first one is Fuerza Guerrera, who is Juventud Guerrera's father, Madonna's boyfriend, who is Luis Spicoli, who I forgot to mention, another guy who made, some impact in wrestling, in the United States wrestling in the 90s, and Psicosis against Rey Mysterio Jr., Heavy Metal and Latin Lover. And that's really just kind of like a, fast-paced both teams against each other. Spicoli kind of being, one of the big dominant, bigger than anyone else in the match, and a pretty big guy, battling against Mysterio trying, throughout the match at different times to be able to outmaneuver and knock Spicoli down, and toward the end he finally does, and it's this, big accomplishment. And then the other six man, you kind of have the focus is on Jerry Estrada, La Parca, who are teammates but who are battling against each other throughout the entire thing, and Blue Panther, their partner, who's just kind of like, I don't want anything to do with this. And then it's, the interesting team of Pegasus Kid, also Chris Benoit, Too Cold Scorpio, and Santana, and just sort of interesting, they're similar type matches, they go similar length, but they tell very different stories.
Yeah, and I have to say, too, that there's a spot after the second six-man with Estrada and La Parca feuding within the match, like you said.
Right.
There's a spot after the match where I think Estrada pulled at La Parca's mask or something. They got into a little scuffle, and it looked real, So they did a really good job, because you thought that they were actually going to tear each other apart,
Yeah, that was really – I mean, obviously there's just – there's the colorful outfits, and there's a lot of fancy moves, and you kind of, on first glance, you may kind of think, oh, this is just sort of silly and fun, but not really substantial. But as you look into it deeper, you really see that there's a seriousness, there's like a gravity to a lot of it, especially when they they really build up the individual feuds.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's present in a lot of major lucha events too. They have a really well-rounded selection, whether it's a visual art or comedy or brawling. A lot of the cards from top to bottom have a little bit of everything, and a lot of American promotions try to offer that too, some successful and some not, but
right. Yeah, I really appreciate some that can bring a lot of variety. I feel like that's missing somewhat in like a WWE today, for instance, where they have different characters, but it just seems like the style is very much, by design, is very, very much the same from match to match to match, with certain exceptions. But basically, you're not seeing like, you know, a big high-flying match in one and then more like mat-based in another. You just kind of have more limited set of moves and a set of what they do, for better or for worse, where something like this, it's just much broader and much more exciting. And I feel like WCW copied that to great effect in the late 90s. Obviously, the luchadors were a big part of that, but they had different styles, you know, from Japan, from guys from the United States, from just everyone. They just kind of brought something different, and they weren't afraid to have diversity in the styles of wrestling they presented.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest mistakes that, you know, not to always pick on WWE, but one of their biggest mistakes, I think, is, you know, they have, everybody has a power finisher, everybody has a submission holds, 90% of the guys have a top rope move of some sort that they usually go for, you know, I mean, like a John Cena or something, like if you have him doing any sort of top rope move, then I think that kind of takes away from your special attraction high flying match if you were to present something like that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and then I get, you know, before we talk about the main event, obviously I think the match that this show is maybe best known for is Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero, taking on Octagon and El Hijo del Santo. Not pronouncing very well today. and it is 2 out of 3 falls, mask versus hair. And I guess it's notable that I believe all the matches on this show were actually single fall matches except for this match, 2 out of 3 falls, which I think is a good decision for the show and maybe for the audience that what they were trying to get, which, you know, I probably was mostly, because of the WCW co-promotion, wasn't audience that wasn't necessarily familiar with Mexican wrestling and familiar with these guys. So I think making that accommodation probably, you know, was a good, you know, point of entry for a lot of people rather than having them all be 2 out of 3 falls. And it also allowed this match maybe to stand out a little bit more than it would have.
Absolutely. I think a big purpose of this entire show was, like you said, you know, to give people a starting point to try, try Lucha out. That's apparent with the English commentary and all that also. But not only was the Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero match 2 out of 3 falls, but it was also sort of elimination style within each fall, because in order to secure a fall for your team, you had to pin both members of the opposing team.
Right.
So that really opened up a lot of options for a back and forth build to really get the crowd into it and worked up, and they did a hell of a job, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's just incredible heat forward, you know, incredible action, incredible looking like that the good guys are in jeopardy and then them able to make comebacks, but making them in a way that felt like, you know, more realistic or more organic than sometimes you get that way. You would get that like in the stereotypical Hogan or Cena match. I don't know. I felt like they were really overcoming an obstacle, but they were doing it in a way that like that worked. You know, it just really is really artfully done, for lack of a better term.
Right. It was as realistic. It was real as realistic as it could be within the confines of the, you know, the Lucha Libre world.
Right, which is sort of fantastical, but yet is a weird mix of that, but yet being grounded in such passion, I guess, and such, you know, fervor, maybe is the way to put it. And you can tell that by the crowd, because this crowd, in certain parts of the show, particularly in that match and in the main event, they really are just, you know, they're part of the show. I mean, they're, you know, there's fights with people in the crowd, and there's just, you can really just see the heat building as, you know, as the show and as the matches progress, you know, within each match and as the show progresses.
Yeah, the crowd was on fire, and, you know, and when they'd cut to the crowd, you would see people of all age groups. So it really shows that how popular this style of wrestling is. in Mexico, and it's not just like a kid thing. I mean, you can say the same thing about American wrestling, obviously, but
sure.
It, you know, obviously kids are a big draw to it in America.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually went to a lucha show when I did a study abroad in Mexico when I was in college, and it was really, really neat. I don't really remember the particulars of the show anymore. I just remember I remember the atmosphere. I remember the crowd. I remember feeling like there was just really so much passion and so much investment. I remember the final match was a mask versus mask match. I just remember like just be really feeling involved and really feeling invested. And, you know, I'm a big wrestling fan, but I haven't felt that way at a live show that often. I mean, I've enjoyed them certainly, but I just really felt like a different level of commitment from everyone in there. And it wasn't like it wasn't like an ironic thing, or it wasn't like a smart thing. It was just like, we were watching this theater that we were all really emotionally invested in the outcome for, and it was really cool.
Right.
I guess basically they explain the story as Aguayo and Conan had sort of feuded while Conan was on the rise. Aguayo took Conan's mask, and then Conan beat Aguayo in a hair match, and then they were tag team for a while, and then Conan eventually turned on him, and they were battling again. Maybe kind of like a Paul Orndorff Hogan thing, or even a Savage Hogan thing, where they had this big battle and then they came together and then they were torn apart again. So, and the Aguayo sort of described as like the everyman who never gives up. He's like a 24-year-old veteran. He's won over 24 titles. He looks pretty grizzled. He's in kind of his attire was sort of similar to Jimmy Snuka, or like Chief J Strongbow, I would say. He had sort of like the tan, dark boots, and the dark and the dark trunks, and had sort of longer brown hair, sort of a shoulder length for those who have not seen Paraguayo. And Conan looked much different than he did in his late 90s WCW. His most famous point in the United States, he had dreadlocks. He had sort of like a Rob Van Dam or Ultimate Warrior singlet. It was very colorful. And he sort of had, I guess, was sort of like a big strong man persona, because at this point he was pretty jacked. He was kind of like, it was based on Conan the Barbarian was where he got his name. They even explained that at the beginning of the match.
Right. And definitely the story that this tells, like you said, I mean, Aguayo, grizzled is the word to use for him, because, you know, he had the scars comparable to, you know, the foreheads of Sabu or Abdullah the Butcher, someone where you can just take one look and you know the type of punishment that they've gone through throughout their career, and
sure,
the elements of realism in a supposedly fake sport or whatever.
Sure.
And you had Conan coming in, you know, the cocky youth, and what I liked about his entrance, you know, he had the hood, kind of like think of you know, Ultimate Warrior in 1998 with, you know, his colorful OWN jacket or whatever.
Sure.
You want to call that,
right? And yeah,
combined with like, you know, an AJ Styles kind of hood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it reminded me of like a boxer's entrance.
Yeah. They make some parallels to the recent, at the time, Ric Flair versus Hulk Hogan match. They had wrestled at Halloween Havoc 94 about a month before, or maybe just a couple weeks before. And then Hogan had won a cage match and retired Flair in it. They keep on going about the size of the cage. They call it a 10-foot cage, which I was like, the 10-foot cage really tall? But it was pretty tall. It was definitely taller than the typical cage of the time. And interestingly enough, it was over-the-top rules. And is that a common thing in Lucha? Do you know?
I do not know.
Okay. I don't. I mean, I haven't really, like I said, I haven't watched a whole lot of Lucha, so I wasn't really sure if that was a common thing, because that's obviously, you know, famous WWF style cage rules.
Yeah.
And over the top cage matches that usually aren't my favorite types, although this I think makes it work pretty well. It doesn't drag it down, and there's still a lot of. There's more of them battling each other than fighting each other than there is one guy trying to escape another guy, which is never really that exciting, or rarely that exciting unless you do it really well.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely a brawl, but they did a great job with, you know, back and forth psychology and telling the story, incorporating the cage, but they didn't really overdo any one aspect. Like you said, they didn't have anybody trying to climb over and over again. They had a good mix of everything going back and forth.
Right, absolutely. So far as the match goes, we have Conan starts off with a press slam showing his power. And there's a crisscross, and then Aguayo knocks him down repeatedly with some drop kicks and some boots. Conan then begs off and then looks for the door, even though the door is shut, so you can't go through the door. You can only climb. And then one thing that's maybe hurts the match a little bit, but it's not a big deal, is Aguayo does a roll up for a pinning position, and there's no pin. And he does this several times, which always seems like I get the first time because maybe it's just sort of establishing like, oh yeah, he forgot for a second, and he forgot that he can't do a pin. He needs to do the thing. But when you do it repeatedly, it just makes the guy look dumb. So
yeah, especially when it's the veteran, you know.
Right.
If the whole angle was, oh no, you know, Conan's never been in a cage match, and it was Conan that did it, that would be different.
Yeah.
And you know, I usually like spots like that. But again, it has to make sense, and you can't do it over and over again. So
exactly, yeah. There's Greg Valentine, Ron Garvin, I Quit match. I think it's at the 90 Royal Rumble, where like they seriously go for like 8 pin attempts, and you're just like, guys, this is a submission match, you know. So anyway, Conan then gets a low blow to sort of shut down Aguayo for a little bit. Tanay actually mentions Conan's appearance at Starrcade 1990, of all things, which he had mentioned periodically guys who had some runs in WCW. Like he mentioned Too Cold Scorpio's run as tag champion with Marcus Bagwell, Buff Bagwell. He mentioned Tito Santana's tenure in WWF because he was. Santana would have been the guy best known by U.S. audiences at this point. So the couple things like that, but he, interestingly enough, he did not mention Benoit's WCW appearances, even though Benoit had, you know, 3 or 4 pay-per-view matches in WCW between like 90 and 93. So I thought that was a little odd, but yeah, he does mention Conan's brief appearance in Starrcade 1990 in the Pat O'Connor Memorial Tag Team Tournament. Very prestigious. I believe he got to the semifinals, as they said. So,
yeah, I think I've seen that a few years back. It's been a while.
It's a good, pretty good tournament, actually. They have a lot. It's not quite as good. The WCW had a good 92 tournament for the NWA tag titles, kind of brought them back. And that's the one Benoit is there with Beef Wellington and, I think Liger teams with Brian Pillman and Steamboat Nikita Koloff and a lot of cool teams in that one. But one thing WCW and before even they were WCW, NWA did well is they did tag tournaments really well. Like the Jim Crocker Memorial tournaments were always good, and you know they could book them some good tag tournaments.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, they even had their creative ideas that didn't necessarily work out too well, like the Battle Bowl, but I would love to see that happen again. Like, those were fun.
Yeah. Well, I like the Lethal Lottery part. The Battle Bowl part itself, I'm not a fan of, but the Lethal Lottery stuff, I always thought that was a cool concept. I like the random, you know, pairings. That can be like a fun, like, one-night tournament type thing, you know? So we have... then eventually Aguayo is trying to climb on the top, and he stands on Conan's throat for a little bit as Conan tries to pull him down, but eventually Conan's able to get the advantage. Then Conan gets Para with a hot shot into the cage, and Aguayo's face smashes into the cage, and then Conan even follows with a stronger one, and after that, Pero is bleeding quite significantly. It doesn't take very long for that blood to come pouring out.
Yeah, very early on in the match, too.
Yeah, we're probably maybe 2-3 minutes in, and already there's a lot of decent amount of blood coming out. And I love, just a little bit later, there's a flash across the screen that says, Parental discretion is advised. It's like, might be a little late for that, guys. You know,
better late than never, I guess.
Yeah. So Conan works him over for a while, sends him into the corner, rubs his face repeatedly into the mesh, stands on his head while blood goes down on his forehead. But they get a really great close-up of that, of just the blood pouring down and Peril looking really sympathetic and looking really, you know, spent and beaten already, and like he's really struggling and in trouble. So we get Conan climbs up, and then Pero gets him in the electric chair position and knocks him down. Then he sort of whiffs on a drop kick, but Conan falls back anyway, which they sort of try to cover up and explain that, you know, maybe he was just expecting it or whatever, but that a little bit of a mess up there. Then we have one of many double foot stomps by Pero, was something he apparently was known for, and the crowd goes crazy every time he does it, so clearly something they knew as well.
I'm always impressed by that move. I can't for the life of me understand how they can pull that off without injuring each other.
Yeah.
Or the guy receiving it, I mean.
Exactly, right. Yeah, that is pretty impressive. I guess you must have to stomp right in the right place.
Yeah.
So, and he Pera climbs up, but Conan also heads to the top, and they fight atop the ropes for a bit. Conan ends up tumbling down, and then Pera comes from the top and clotheslines him down. Then hits another double stomp, which gets a huge reaction. And then we have another attempt at a roll-up, ill-advised attempt at a roll-up. then he pounds on Conan's forehead for a little bit, slams him against the cage, and then does a double foot stomp off of the second rope. Then Pero climbs and gets near the top, but Conan grabs a boot, and then Conan slams Pero's face in the bars on the outside of the cage, almost looking like he's going to fall from the other hand. And then eventually Pero elbows him down and then does a standing senton. Then we have Eddie and Luis Piccoli come out. Eddie, of course, I don't think we actually mentioned that it was a double. The previous match was a double mask versus double hair match, and Eddie and Art Barr end up losing their hair. So we have Eddie with newly shorn locks. They come out, grab a drink, and they toss it in Pero's face. And then they end up giving Conan some brass knucks. And Conan taunts the crowd, and by this time they're even more fired up. And then they spend the next few minutes. He will nail Pero with some of the knucks. And then tossing them back out to Eddie, which I don't really understand why he didn't just keep them the whole time, but, you know, whatever. He's, I guess it's some sort of, like, oh, I don't really need these type thing, but, like, oh, well, I might as well get them anyway. Conan hits a Niagara driver, which is basically like a razor's edge into a sit-out powerbomb.
Yeah, I have I think that's the only time I've ever seen that move. I don't know if you've ever seen it before, but
I've only seen it on WCW, NWO, or maybe World Tour and Revenge, where it's actually one of Conan's moves, I believe, in that match. So, interestingly enough.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but he never did in WCW, certainly. By then, he wasn't strong enough to do it to most guys, I would imagine.
But, you know, I saw that and I'm like, why on earth is no one in WWE using this move right now? Or even TNA.
Yeah.
It's awesome. If done right, it's a beautiful finisher. Yeah.
Maybe it's a little bit dangerous, you know?
Could be.
Yeah, that would be my guess. Or you'd have to be really strong to do it too. And you know, there aren't a lot of guys who are that strong to be able to do it safely every time.
Yeah, maybe they're trying to, cut down on unnecessary risks these days.
Yeah,
which is understandable, but it's kind of a double-edged sword as a viewer, because you want these guys to be safe, but you also want to see, you know, the unhuman feats happen, you know?
Sure. Yeah. I thought it was cool, but yeah, I could certainly live without it, you know, if it's a safety issue. But you're right. There definitely is a balance on that. And even wrestling that doesn't necessarily look as risky, it's all dangerous. I mean, you know, something could go wrong on a body slam or what have you. So there's certainly, you know, it's impossible to eliminate the risks. But so anyway, you get some more action with the brass knucks. Eddie even tries to sort of get into the cage, but Pepe Casas, the good guy referee, where they explain at the beginning of the show the differences between, you know, the good guy referees and the bad guy referees. Most of the matches have both referees, but I believe I only see Pepe Casas out here for this one for some reason. And he tries to get them to stop, and then Pepe actually pulls Eddie down by the tights, and you briefly see a bit of Eddie mooning the crowd. So eventually Conan tosses out the knucks again, and we have Pero just covered with blood on his face and on his chest. Conan does a suplex and some martial arts, and you kind of see that he's a little bit raw in his moves. You know, he'd been probably was a 3 or 4 year pro at this point, and was in a lot of main events, but he still, you know, showed a little bit of the rawness. You know, he's still obviously young in his career, and was kind of a raw worker in any case, you know, from what I've seen.
Yeah, definitely. But it worked for the crowd though. I mean, Well, no, I mean, he wasn't the baby face, obviously, but I mean, whatever works. I mean, he was a red hot heel, and I mean, the crowd was at this point was on fire. The Dynamite Brothers came out next. You know, they said that they weren't even unannounced. They weren't even announced on the crowd, and I don't know if the pop was pro Dynamite Brothers or just so anti Guerrero and Spicoli and, you know, and Conan, but I mean the crowd, you know, erupted when these two guys came out.
Yeah.
Which was interesting.
Right. And it was, yeah, it's Mascara Año Dos Mil and Universo Dos Mil, and also Cien Caras. And Cien Caras, they mentioned earlier during the match, he and Conan had, I believe it was a triple mania, but it was an event that like had drawn like 50,000 people, and Cien Caras and Conan had this like big long, you know, blood feud. It was sort of after Aguayo had feuded, or after the, you know, the Aguayo feud. So, you know, this is basically like one of Conan's big rivals getting involved and keeping, after Conan has been using the Nux so many times, finally, the other two run out, Eddie and Spicoli, and then Conan heads to the top, and then Caras climbs up and then nails Conan with the right hand, sort of a, you know, sort of evening things up, sort of, you know, after all the shenanigans, you know, getting his just desserts. And after that point, Pero nails Conan's head repeatedly into the cage, busts him open, hits a Samoan drop, and then goes to the top, and then hits another double stomp. And this one just gets, you know, crazy reaction from the crowd. And then he heads up the other way and climbs over the top to the win. And you just have a wonderful, like, visual at the end of, Paraguayo all bloody, screaming Viva Mexico, taking a post-match victory lap around and just being, you know, really excited. Because kind of the conceit of this part of the show is it's IWC versus AAA, which I don't know what IWC exactly was supposed to be, but I kind of got the idea that, like, IWC was supposed to represent the United States, and AAA was supposed to represent Mexico, and a lot of the heels, particularly Eddie and Art Barr, what was the name of their team? I'm blanking on the name of their team, but
Los Gringos Locos.
Right, Los Gringos Locos, exactly. Yes, and they obviously were, you know, basically the American team acting as the heels in Mexico and bringing up like Prop 187, which was a big anti-immigrant measure in California at the time. And, you know, basically belittling Mexico and saying how great the United States was and basically being, you know, the arrogant foreign heel type that we are used to here in the United States, but obviously doing it as, you know, as Americans. So and I think Conan also represented part of that group. He wasn't doing the over the top thing, at least not in this match, but he was, you know, on that side. So kind of the end here is Paraguay winning this match for Mexico and for Mexican pride and so on and so forth. So I think that obviously added to the emotion of the crowd, even though it's in Los Angeles in the United States. Most of the, you know, crowd is pro Mexico, at least in this respect.
Yeah. And I think all of the heat from the Guerrero match carried over with the crowd, because, you know, especially when you had Guerrero and Spicoli coming out, I think that you're definitely right about the recurring theme throughout the whole show was kind of like a U.S. versus Mexico thing, you know, the United States being like the evil foreigners invading Mexico. And,
right. Yeah, and even like the Pegasus Kid, Too Cold Scorpio, and Tito Santana match was basically, you know, American stars, or you know basically representing America or Canada or whatever against the Mexican team. You know, the first two matches were pretty much Mexico versus Mexico, but the last three were all, you know, kind of this, you know, these Americans versus Mexicans. And in the, you know, the first of those, the six man, that wasn't really played up so much, because again, it was more the story of the teammates not getting along. And it wasn't like the Americans weren't really playing heels. They were more just, you know, playing wrestlers trying to win a match, you know. But the other two matches definitely really, you know, played into that. And whether yep. Conan was more just a generic heel, but he was definitely on that side. I mean, he had in his trunks, he had like the, you know, red, white, and blue colors, and was, you know, and was part of that, at least loosely affiliated with that. I don't know, obviously don't know the storylines from 1994 and AAA, but obviously you're meant to infer that he's part of it. So,
not to mention, you know, if he had spent some time in WCW at the time already, they may have considered him, you know, looked at him as like a traitor or something. I'm not really familiar with lead up to the show.
Yeah,
but
I don't think he, other than Starrcade 90, I don't think he had an appearance in WCW. So I'm not sure that would have really played into it at this point. But
oh, okay.
But yeah. So and then afterward, we kind of get, you know, really the crowd again gets in the post match. I mean, Conan even goes into the crowd and goes after a fan, and then Aguayo even like runs in and sort of tries to break it up. I mean, he doesn't really go after Conan. It's more just like, you know, trying to get everyone to calm down, I guess. And eventually everyone gets separated. So there's a lot of heat, you know, for the whole thing. And it's a great atmosphere. It's anyone, you know, I this match, I definitely recommend seeing it. The whole show, really, it's only it's a little bit more than 2 hours, and it's a really great show to watch. It's really, really fun and really, you know, really, really excellent.
Yeah, I mean, it's hands down one of the best top to bottom wrestling cards I have ever seen. And, you know, when I started the Ruto Reels website, it was kind of a learning experience, you know, as much as, you know, a way to, you know, start a business or whatever. But Lucha Libre and Japanese wrestling were two areas that I hadn't really learned much about. So, I mean, this was the first full Lucha show that I watched, and it's amazing. I would compare it to any major American wrestling show.
Yeah.
Easily comparable to any of the WrestleManias, and love it.
Yeah. And, you know, even if you're not, like, if you don't know much about Lucha, if you're just looking as like a good introductory point, this really did feel like a good one. I mean, granted, it's almost 20 years old now, but I just felt like I got to understand the characters and I got to kind of understand what they were doing when, you know, some Lucha, it's just the psychology is so different in a lot of ways from the wrestling that I'm used to. I have just sometimes have a hard time connecting to it. But with the commentary, you know, particularly Tanay kind of explaining the context, explaining, okay, this is kind of why they're doing what they're doing, I got it a lot better. So I think it's a really good starting point for, you know, a good place to start if you're interested in expanding your horizons and watching some Lucha.
And I think it's really... Also, the fact that the commentary is in English is a major, major help for people
right.
Thinking of trying Lucha, because one of the common complaints or whatever you want to call it from people thinking of trying Japanese wrestling or Mexican wrestling is, you know, they're kind of hesitant because they can't get into it because they can't understand the commentary.
Sure.
So this is a real good way to get past that.
Yeah, definitely. Very agreed. So definitely, definitely worth checking out, and it's also available at rootareels.com.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
$5.99 for it on two DVDs or $2.99 for a download.
There you go. Very good deal. All right, Franny. Well, of course, anything else you want to mention? Of course, you're on Twitter.
Yes, I am. Follow me on Twitter at RudoReels. It's simple as that. Also on Facebook.
All right, cool. Well, definitely, it's a good site to check out. I definitely recommend it. And thanks for being on the show. Really appreciate your insight on this match. And thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Of course, we'll be back with more main events in the future. So keep checking us out, WrestleSpective.com. And you can find us, WrestleSpective, at Twitter and on Facebook. So definitely be looking at those places while you're checking out Rooter Reels. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back again soon.